All right, we're on. So I'm here in New York this time with John Emile Kenny, and we're going to chat about some interesting stuff. Thanks for coming, John.
Thanks for inviting me. It's good to see you in New York.
So the first thing we figured we'd talk about was a topic that John just came up with about ascites, renal dysfunction, nephrologists, and gastroenterologists, and of course physiology, and maybe a touch of ultrasound. So go ahead, tell me what you were just starting to say.
Recently, based on a patient, for anonymity, patient came in, bad cirrhosis, massive ascites, took out 11 liters out of the belly, then the patient was complicated by a duodenal bleed, creatinine barely nudged, patient was still urinating, yet moving forward in all of the patient's notes, physicians were writing, likely suffered pre-renal insult from large volume paracentesis. And I was just thinking, you know, literally, if you pulled 11 liters out of anywhere in the body, you know, the patient should essentially collapse from hemodynamic compromise. So the fact that the patient maintained urination, mentation, blood pressure, stroke volume, you know, essentially a normal creatinine after an 11-liter withdrawal really makes me question this notion of hemodynamic embarrassment after a large volume paracentesis. I'm wondering how you, if you've encountered this somewhat of a, maybe of a myth or a dogma, and how you approach it.
Yeah, I think that's, I've seen those types of cases a fair bit. And I think the trick is that everyone's just guessing on what their pre-intervention intravascular volume status was. Almost in the same way that also people like arbitrarily will give Lasix after a transfusion. Well, it really depends on what person was anemic from, you know? Like if they were slowly anemic, they're totally euvolemic, they don't necessarily, they probably need some Lasix. If they got anemic because they bled out, then they're probably volume depleted, and they don't need the Lasix. But in this kind of cases, it's the same thing. I think they were assuming that the patient was of some type of possibly euvolemic or hypovolemic to start with. You drain that out, it creates a bit of a sink, and obviously they're going to, as they start reaccumulating the ascites, they're going to get a little more hypovolemic. But without looking, are we allowed having some, you know, objective assessment of intravascular volume? I don't think there's any way to know. So it becomes an absolute guess. And I think in the services of nephrology and gastroenterology, you know, by no fault of their individual selves, this is how they've been taught to practice. This is how, you know, 99% of people practice. It's a guess. So without looking, I think you're going to run into some of those issues of dogmatic practice.
Yeah. I find it to be a very challenging clinical scenario, you know, even ultrasonographic assessment in these patients. I don't know how you approach it, but, you know, somebody with massive ascites, presumed intra-abdominal hypertension, kind of, I think even some of them are even approaching compartment-ish physiology, you know, a small diminutive IVC certainly is, at that point, dissociated from central venous pressure and right atrial pressure, and with every inspiration, intra-abdominal pressure is going to go up much higher and therefore favor collapse of the IVC. So, you know, you look at the IVC and it's hard to make any sort of assessment on their filling pressure. You can look at the heart, unless they've got an alcoholic cardiomyopathy or portal pulmonary hypertension or something from a complication of their cirrhosis, they usually have a normal squeeze. And I find that a lot of these patients don't have B-lines on lung ultrasound. It just seems like they partition their fluid into their abdomen. And so managing their volume status at that point becomes, I think, exceptionally tricky, especially when they start getting renal failure. I don't know if you have an approach to that.
Well, I think part of it is not looking at the ultrasound examination as a single shot. So I think definitely if you see that in the beginning, you feel that belly, it's a little tight. That's one thing. I get a lot of pundits that'll say, well, you know, the IVC is not always trustworthy. It lies. I said, it doesn't actually ever lie. It always is what it is. You have to interpret it in the whole context.
Yeah.
And if your belly is, you know, pretty firm, then you have to look at that small IVC with a grain of not a grain of salt, but because it's just been compressed. So then the trick is to look at it after you've taken out a couple liters. And once you've loosened up that pressure, and it doesn't take that much to loosen up that pressure, then see what the IVC's done. If all of a sudden it's gone up in size, now it's, 15 millimeters and it's got a normal variation, well, the person wasn't dry. It was just being compressed. And serial examination for a lot of things, whether it's fluid resus or this kind of scenario, I think is absolutely key.
Yeah. In the thinking about the physiology of massive ascites, digging into the literature a bit, I kind of feel like almost the cardiologists are on the right page, or at least on the right scent. And there's been a number of really nice reviews in JACC. One that I read just recently from about 2013. I forget who the first author is. I'm going to write about it soon, but talking about the notion of back pressure, venous congestion, intra-abdominal hypertension, and they go through a lot of really interesting mechanisms as to how intra-abdominal hypertension, they're approaching it from a heart failure perspective, because it's a cardiologist, but intra-abdominal hypertension, venous congestion, how that causes essentially the nephrons to think that they're dry. And so you can get salt-avid nephrons, you can get a high BUN to creatinine ratio, you can get all of these urinary and serum indices that make you think that the patient is quote-unquote volume down, but in fact it's just the kidneys behaving as if the nephrons are under-perfused. So I'm curious, have you ever had any situations where you've done a large volume paracentesis and your output has improved, BUN creatinine has improved, all indices of nephron functioning is getting better?
Absolutely. Like, actually not that long ago, I had a colleague of mine, we have a two-person team, so he was on the consult side. He'd asked me my opinion about exactly this. We'd had a guy who came in who didn't have a great squeeze. So he had a pretty full IVC, with an LVEF that must have been in the 30s or something like that, and he was in renal failure. Bumped up, I think, 1.5 times his usual, and he had a huge amount of ascites. So his question was, well, do I diurese this guy? Mm. Do I diurese and paracentese? What do I do? So the actual question there was that this was a pre-renal state. Or hepatorenal, but that was the thing, and that they had consulted us to maybe try and increase his cardiac output to get increased flow to the kidneys. I told him, why don't we just start by draining his ascites?
Yeah.
We'll drain the ascites. We don't have any worries since this guy is intravascularly fairly full, and we'll see if that creates enough decompression of his IVC to help the kidneys.
Mm-hmm.
And the nephrologists were all over this. They were not happy about this.
Really?
Yeah, they were not happy about this. They really felt this was pre-renal, and then they wanted to give him albumin, regularly scheduled albumin, before and while we drained. And I said, I don't think that makes any sense to me at all, because I have a congested patient with congested kidneys, a bad LV.
Yeah.
And I can't come up with a single reason why I should put any additional drop of fluid into his intravascular system. So we drained, and everything improved.
Yeah.
And actually what we saw is that his IVC came down a little bit, mm-hmm. started to have a little bit of variation. It's still pretty juicy,
mm-hmm.
but it started to have a little bit of respiratory variation. And we took out probably about 5 liters or something like that.
Okay.
And his kidneys just slowly came back down.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah, mechanistically, there's a lot of neat stuff here, and in this cardiology review, they go through some of it. Some of the data is really, really old. Even some of it dates back over 100 years. Where if you literally just tie off the renal vein and increase renal venous pressure, in a dog or in a porcine model, the kidneys release renin, the nephrons begin to absorb salt. And I haven't come across a good explanation as to why. Two competing theories I've come across is that when you tie off the renal vein, you diminish blood flow through the kidney, you diminish glomerular filtration, you diminish sodium and chloride delivery to the distal tubule, and from juxtaglomerular feedback, the kidneys release renin in response to essentially, you know, become salt avid, constrict the efferent arterial, and improve glomerular filtration. It's sort of a responsive element. And another explanation I've come across is just simply compression, physical compression of the kidney and the nephrons, diminishing the wall stretch across the afferent arterial, which then releases renin.
Right.
Because essentially, if you're compressing the afferent arterial from the outside, it's a dumb kidney, so it just thinks I'm dry, I'm underperfused, get more perfusion.
Right.
So they become salt avid, and you get into this vicious cycle where the more ascites you get, the more salt avid you get. So breaking the cycle, in theory, will then perfuse the kidneys from releasing the intra-abdominal pressure. One other really cool explanation I came across was diminished portal vein blood flow. That if you could imagine, if you're developing intra-abdominal hypertension and the portal vein is becoming compressed and you have diminished flow through the portal vein, well, the liver has, at least in a rat model, a mechanistic reflex with the kidney, and this is stuff I've just learned recently, that if the liver is underperfused, there's a reflex arc, which then causes the kidneys to become salt avid. And I'm probably saying, I think it goes through cyclic AMP or something, or no, adenosine. It goes through adenosine, that if the liver is underperfused from the portal vein, there's literally a shared reflex with the kidneys that then become, cause them to be salt avid, which makes sense, because if the liver is underperfused, the liver sensing, you know, volume depletion, and it would then trigger the kidneys to get more salt and water.
So basically, if we want to summarize that, that basically when you see a salt avid state, meaning a low urinary sodium, you can't equate that to low arterial perfusion.
Correct.
Or low cardiac output or low flow state, like people like to label it.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I teach my house staff all the time is that, you know, salt avid kidneys, a high BUN creatinine ratio, a high urine osmolality, you know, in response to ADH, tells you that nephrons are alive. Once you know that nephrons are alive and functioning, then the next question is, what's the volume status? You can't say, oh, the nephrons are alive, they must be hypovolemic. It's nephrons alive, yes, no. You know, if they're not alive, then it's probably ATN. You've got dead nephrons. If the nephrons are alive, then you've got to think about the patient and really determine their volume status. Because, you know, from heart failure patients, from, you know, cirrhotic patients, that the nephrons can be functioning appropriately, but you can still be massively volume overloaded. And in the patient that you presented, you know, if their intra-abdominal pressure was, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 millimeters of mercury, you're starting to potentially impair renal perfusion directly as a consequence of the intra-abdominal hypertension. You are potentially impairing hepatic perfusion, potentially as a consequence of portal vein compression. And you're also potentially retarding venous return to the right heart, right? So you're going to diminish your stroke volume. And in a patient with a bad LV, I think you could make a very strong explanation that the only thing you would need to do to that patient is just decompress the abdomen, reperfuse the kidneys, reperfuse the liver. In theory, if you've got a bad LV and you decompress the abdomen, you could actually run into a problem where you could kind of, for lack of a better term, flash the patient.
Okay, you want to go through that a little bit more?
Like if somebody, say, had an EF of 10% and the intra-abdominal pressure was massive and impairing venous return, it's almost like they're getting Lasix or a venodilator, right? You're kind of almost treating their heart failure. You're lowering their venous return, which in an EF of 10%, the heart might like. And so if you were to suddenly decompress the abdomen, you would run the risk. It clearly didn't affect your patient. If anything, they got better. But if you suddenly increased venous return, if they were entering kind of a tamponade-like physiology, or and you lowered the intra-abdominal pressure, then you increase venous return to an LV of EF of 10%, you could run into problems, and it lends credence to your argument, like, why would I give on albumin on top of that?
Yeah.
Do you regularly give albumin to large volume paracentesis?
No, I don't, unless someone would be clearly hypovolemic. So if they had a small IVC, say, and a softish belly after some drainage, and it's remaining small, and then if I'm going to give them something, I'd probably tend to give them albumin. I know that, you know, the data on that isn't clear, you know, but I think if I'm going to give them something, well, I know they're going to reaccumulate their ascites eventually. Mm-hmm. Might as well try and have it a little bit slower by giving me an albumin is the rationale I use for it. But I wouldn't give it just because I took out fluid.
Yeah.
To me, that just makes no physiological sense. I have to have a reason to do it.
Yeah. The guidelines I've come across is like you don't need to do it under 5 liter removal, but above 5 liter, then you give back 8 grams per liter that you take off. But I agree, these are guidelines, like, you've got to sort of, like, think about the patient, you know, do they truly need preload? There's probably a lot of patients where you could literally take out 12 liters, mm-hmm. and they don't necessarily need more preload, especially if they've got a crummy heart, if they've got an alcoholic cardiomyopathy, if they've got portal pulmonary hypertension, valvular dysfunction. This is where the power, I think, of bedside echocardiography comes in. If you can get that information for yourself prior to hemodynamic interventions, you're going to save yourself a lot of headache in the future. If you just did it blindly,
then it's a best guess kind of situation.
You know, if they had a perfectly normal heart and you just did it blindly, you know, maybe 8 or 9 times out of 10, you're going to be totally fine in ignorance. But there's going to be those few times when the patient really has some sort of cardiac embarrassment where giving them more preload could do a lot more harm than good.
Awesome. All right. I think that's good for this topic.
Sure. Yeah.
Thanks very much.